From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the late 1990s when a woman from Rochester made a phone call to her mother. The woman, around 30 years old, had monumental news to share. Sonia Livingston had wanted desperately to have a child. It had been a difficult road, if we want to resort to euphemism. Tests, probes, meetings, efforts to employ just about the full panoply of human reproductive innovation. And finally, Sonia could call her 58-year-old mother and tell her, "I'm pregnant." She could not possibly have expected what happened next because her mother said, remember, 58 years old, "I'm pregnant too." This is but one moment in a book filled with honesty, insight, and often relatable events. I say often because most of us will not be able to relate to that particular moment, a daughter and a mother sharing the same news of pregnancy. But you'll want to read the book to find out what happens next and really to experience tremendous writing and a series of tremendous stories. The book is called Queen of the Fall, a memoir of girls and goddesses. Writers and Books has selected Queen of the Fall for its 2016 edition of If All of Rochester Reads the Same Book. The author is in town for a series of events, workshops, discussions, I think a bus tour if I saw, all kinds of cool stuff. This hour, Sonia Livingston is my guest on Connections. Lovely to have you here. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you, Evan.
It's great to have you here. And Chris Fanning from Writers and Books is here as well, who's simply going to make sure that we know where people can meet Sonia, can talk about it, can get the book, etc. Because it's already going on, right, Chris?
It's already happening.
And it's happening until when? When do you wrap all of this up?
We wrap all this up next Saturday after Sonia's masterclass.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we will get to the schedule of events coming up here. And Chris, by the way, you guys pick great books, man. I said to Beth Adams this morning, this has become one of my favorite annual traditions because every year the book is different from the previous year, and I have loved them, all of the ones that I've had a chance to read. Thank you.
That's such a nice compliment. We try.
I feel like I'm complimenting
something.
You. You don't deserve the compliment.
Hey, we all
You're
read
not
it.
The one.
The 10 of us on staff, we read it, all the books that the coordinator suggests and then pick
and
them as
vote.
A staff.
That's
yeah.
great.
Well, you did a wonderful job with this. And Sonia, Rochester's your hometown, but where do you live now?
I live in Memphis. I am an assistant professor at the University of Memphis, where I teach creative writing. But I'm in Rochester frequently. We actually have a little house here, so I come back during breaks.
And you've heard Sonia's voice on this program before. We've talked memoir. We've talked the genre. Mm-hmm. And I think you have such interesting thoughts about memoir because we've gone through the halcyon days of memoir, mm-hmm. and now there's a little bit of a memoir backlash because there's a lot of memoir.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
there's very little memoir, I think, that is this good. I really mean that. But for okay. you, when you talk about memoir and you describe what you do, is there any part of you that fears the backlash that's come from the reading public on memoir?
I don't fear it so much as notice it, because it's true that there is a backlash. People tend to not take memoir or personal writing as seriously, and I understand why. There are some memoirs that have been written that are just not very good, but there are many novels that are written that are not very good that people don't seem as concerned about. So yes, I don't fear it, but I notice it and talk about it a lot with my students.
Your memoir, I guess, style, if we want to put it that way, is so interesting in that you are so honest about memory and how memory can kind of play with us.
Mm-hmm.
And there are moments in the book where you describe an event in vivid detail, and yet there are other moments where you say, you have to be honest that you have to guess that what did we probably say about that?
Mm-hmm.
Or how did we probably react to this? There are also moments where you describe, I think it was the film The Last American Virgin,
mm-hmm.
and you were thinking of the actress.
Mm-hmm.
In your mind, she was playing a French woman, but you realize later in the 80s she played a different character
right.
in a different movie.
Right.
And for a memoirist, that is very honest to say, I'm going to do my best here, but we also know that memory does strange things over the
mm-hmm.
years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know some of the controversy or thinking about memoir is the concern over whether people can really remember all of the details.
Sure.
And I'm really interested in what we remember and how and why. So it makes sense when I write about like that actress to be able to say, oh, actually that wasn't, I thought it was her, but no, she was in a different film. To me, that doesn't detract. I think if a writer does that too much, it might get old. We don't want to be, caught in a murky sea of, misremembering. But in general, I don't worry about making it up or checking facts too much. I really rely on memory.
Yeah, but I think that signal to the reader
mm-hmm.
is an indication that you value, as I guess honest is the right word, as honest an assessment of your own memory as you can give, but you're also not going to misrepresent.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that really matters to me as a reader. Mm, okay. As we talked about on the program about memoirs in the past, and some people like Elizabeth Gilbert and others have occasionally get taken to task about certain embellishments, and is it okay to move certain events, and is it okay just to invent details? I valued that as a reader because clearly to me you had thought about it and you didn't want to misrepresent. And there are times where you're signaling us. I think we probably thought this, but we might not know.
Right. And again, I think it works for me because I'm interested, like I say, in why we remember. When people make things up in memoir, I think they're missing opportunities. So they may feel pressured to put a particular symbol in or a person. But I think if you're writing memoir, why not go with what you remember and see why you remember it? Because obviously it matters. So thank you for noticing that.
And why you remember things in a certain context. Mm-hmm. And you can go right to the start of the book here, picking apples.
Right.
And you paint this beautiful picture, I think, that so many Western New Yorkers, this is what's so neat about reading Sonia's book. Most of our listeners, well, if you're listening right, well, not all of them, we've got listeners all over, but most of our listeners are in Western New York. You're going to find so many different points in the book, a place that you'll know, whether it's apple picking in Western New York, Seneca Army Depot, parts in downtown Rochester, Corpus Christi Church. You can go down the long list. You will relate to it. But I think so many of us just in general think of the wonderful summer days. So I've got a brother in Florida now. I just visited him, and he said, it's like summer the whole year. And I said, yeah, but you might come to take it for granted, because in Western New York, we didn't. And I thought of that when I was reading the opening of picking those apples. But then all of a sudden, there's like this record scratch, and you realize maybe this isn't the beautiful scene. Tell me about that scene.
Yeah, so that scene is about a memory of picking apples that I had when we lived in Albion for a while, Orleans County. And I still have this beautiful memory of the bunch of us kids, seven kids and a single mom, out there picking apples on a beautiful day, blue sky, everything gorgeous. And at one point, I tell my sister about this memory, and she says, she's a year and a half older, and that year and a half makes all the difference, I think, because she says, oh, you mean the time Ma had us working as migrant farmers? And we laughed.
Talk about popping a balloon.
Right. It expanded the scene, right? I still have the memory of the apples and being probably too little to actually have been employed, I hope. But my sister had a different scope, and it was that, hey, we were working, and that isn't anything I fact-checked, but I was really interested in how that could work, how I might have one memory and my sister would have another, and, you know, the same experience, and she may have had fun too, but she had that different overlay on it.
And that's where Queen of the Fall opens. It's a memoir of girls and goddesses by Sonia Livingston, who's my guest for the hour. Grew up in, like you say, spent some time in Albion, et cetera, but grew up in Rochester and understood poverty and understood what it was like growing up without a dad.
Right.
Tell me about that.
The thing about, it's funny, I was recently at, I think maybe Geneseo this was asked, but somebody asked about how would it have been if you had a father and not a mother, and I really struggled to answer that question because that's what I knew. I knew growing up with a mom, and of those seven children, there were five girls, two boys, so it was a very female household. Also, the places we lived, whether it was Albion, New York, or we lived for a while on the Tonawanda Indian Reservation, and then back in the city, the northeast section of Rochester, it wasn't unusual to be a bunch of kids with a mom. That's what most people were growing up with. And the few fathers who were around were sort of scary. You know, they weren't always engaged with the family. And this is nothing about them. They had their own problems, as the moms did. But I guess what I'm saying is I really didn't even know what I was missing until I got older. And now, for instance, I'm married and have a wonderful father-in-law, and I feel the loss of what I didn't have. But as a child, I didn't know anything different.
The circumstances, a lot of people can read about poverty and not fully experience it. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you?
Oh, the poverty. Oh, wow. I'll try to. I'll answer this a couple ways, because looking back, I'll say that it was tough. But when you're in it as a kid, while tough, it's also just my reality. And so what I write about sometimes, and I hope I do as much as possible, is also the really good times. I mean, we were really creative. We had lots of fun. Even that memory of picking apples, it's true that it was corrupted by some more information, but that was a lovely memory. And I think that all children do that. We find ways to be creative as kids and to get through. So yes, it was rough. And I don't recommend poverty as a way to grow up. And clearly in the city of Rochester, lots of kids are struggling with the effects of poverty and what that means for their education and choices. But at the same time, I had some really good times too.
And you write just in moments about your father that He was just knew him being gone on the road, didn't really know him.
I knew stories of him. So he was a vacuum cleaner salesman with a French-Canadian last name, and my mother said he was a good kisser, and that's what I knew about my dad. Which is good. You know, if you can't know anything, it's good to know he's a good kisser.
I don't know. That's sort of a weird thing to know, but okay.
Yeah, yeah. It is weird, I guess, but I clung to it, I guess.
I guess that's better than some alternatives.
It's true.
That's for sure.
Yeah, but the point is, and while that is strange, and as an adult, again, I'm looking with you, we're looking at this with a different perspective. Growing up, I knew kids who didn't know their dads. That was that was sort of normal.
Yeah, and so when people pick up Queen of the Fall, a memoir of girls and goddesses, you know, it sounds like a girl power, a woman power book. In some ways, I think it is. But is there a singular goal that you have in mind with the book beyond, you know, sort of telling your story?
Well, yeah. I mean, my goal is always, even if it is trapped, or structured or filtered through my own personal experiences, my goal is to connect with other human beings, regardless of their class or gender or any of that. So it is definitely focused on the feminine and female experience, especially as it relates to class and religion, I suppose. But I'm very rewarded or gratified as a writer when a male reader says, hey, I really connected with this. There's something here that I get too. So the human experience, if I can tap into that, wonderful.
Oh, I'm a male reader. I definitely connected with this book.
Oh, good.
I loved the affection with which you wrote for Susan B. Anthony. Mm-hmm. Man, you were hard on her though.
I
thought you were kind of hard on her. So I want you to tell the story because you go back and I'm trying to remember here. Were you a young teenager at the time when you were inquiring about the Seneca Falls? When was that? I'm trying to remember.
I think I start the essay with a memory of being in fourth grade.
Azura was fourth grade.
Yeah, okay. So number 33 school. We were doing a classroom play, and they were sort of, we were all supposed to choose historical figures or historic figures from Western New York or, you know, abolition. It was like Famous Do-Gooders was probably the title of the production. And so everybody, you know, chose parts, and Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth and those guys were, you know, sort of, people got them right away. Everybody wanted to be them, but nobody wanted to be Susan B. Anthony. So even though I think that I was hard, to be fair, nobody else, Evan, in that class wanted to be Susan B.
I'm giving you a hard time when I say you were hard on her,
right.
but what
no,
you,
I was.
What
I
you
was.
Were, what you were doing is pointing out, unfortunately, some of the way historically people have looked at Susan B. Anthony,
right.
Which is this never smiling kind of dour.
Right.
And so you had this question in your mind, which is a cool question that people probably don't usually ask about Susan B. Anthony, which is, did that woman ever have any fun?
Right. Did she ever have any fun? And so that's the question. I love that you said that, because I think each essay in this book probably has a question at its heart. And all the questions relate to what it means to be a successful or fruitful woman. And with the Susan B. Anthony essay, I'm particularly interested in, I start off asking, well, did she have any fun? I need to relate to her. And to relate to her, she needs to have hair like Farrah Fawcett or have had a good time at least once in her life. But I think by the end of the essay, I think where I end up is that maybe the problem is not so much with Susan, but with me, that I have difficulty or have had difficulty accepting serious, strong, purposeful women who won't at least lighten the mood with a smile or a joke, and what that might mean for me as a woman and other women. So yes, that is the question. And I sort of want to track down whether she had fun, whether she ate good food. You know, did she have a sweet tooth? Any of that I needed to know in the beginning.
Yeah, but where you end up is a really beautiful place.
Mm.
And what you sort of imagine, what she might think of our world today and what you'd like to talk about with her. And you also, I'm a dad of a four-year-old boy, and we have the book that you talk about here. And I had no idea that the lady with the alligator purse, that connection.
Oh. Okay.
So I learned something new.
Oh, I'm glad that you have that book and that you learned it. Yeah, it was a great song. We loved that song. So my point in the essay is, if only we knew that, maybe Susan B. would have been picked.
Let our listeners in on the secret that they haven't picked it up here. It's The Lady with the Alligator Purse, the book, the copy that we have for our son. I assume they are all the same, right? It's just a short book, and the little baby is eating the bathtub, and they call, mom calls a doctor and a nurse, and then the lady with the alligator purse.
Yeah.
And she's wacky.
The lady, they're all sort of wacky,
but
right?
But she turns out to be, yeah.
Yeah. So the versions are different, but growing up, I think we sang, I'm going to sing right now, and I'm sorry in advance.
Yes.
But Miss Lulu had a baby. She named him Tiny Tim. She put him in the bathtub to see if he could swim. He drank up all the water. He ate up all the soap. He would have ate the bathtub, but it wouldn't go down his throat.
I didn't know that that was the cadence of it.
Yeah.
Because you imagine it's a song. No, I did not.
Because
when I'm reading it to my son, let me see, because you've got little parts of it here.
Right.
I just did, let's see here. I would do like this here. Oh, man, now I'm flipping back here. Mumps, said the doctor. Measles, said the nurse. Vote, said the lady. Well, that's funny.
It may have begun that way.
Vote, said the lady.
Yeah. Both versions are great. I think you should stick with that one.
Yeah. Or pizza. But no, I did it very emphatically. I did not know the song nature of it.
Yes.
And I did not know the Susan B. Mm-hmm. connection there. So I just loved that little story.
Mm-hmm.
And for you as a woman now, you look back as the girl that you were,
mm-hmm.
you know, I loved reading that, but what does that story mean to you now?
Well, it means to me, it helps me look at why I have resisted being serious in my life or purposeful. Not that I want to go the other extreme and, you know, not smile, but in what it has meant. I don't want to get too political, but, you know, like with Hillary Clinton and people focusing on her voice or her demeanor and whether she's a good candidate or not, I'm not talking about that. But the way that we still look at and evaluate strong, purposeful women and what that might mean for me, who would like to evolve as I age and become even stronger. So that I sort of looked at that issue, I guess.
Sonia Livingston's book is Queen of the Fall, a memoir of girls and goddesses, and she has a number of events. How many events, Chris Fanning, did you say? Like 13?
13 is the running mm-hmm. total right now, starting next Tuesday. So.
All right. So can you give us a quick rundown of some of what's coming up with Sonia?
I can. Tuesday the 15th, we've got Wood Library in Candaigua to FLCC, to Palmyra, to Nazareth. Wednesday the 16th, we do RIT, St. John Fisher College, and Penfield. Thursday the 17th, St. Patrick's Day. We should probably
I will wear green.
Coordinate something with that. Central Library. Then we go to the Summit, Greece Library at night. And then Friday, we have Roberts Wesleyan College, mm-hmm. Valley Manor, and then a novel evening with Sonia Livingston that night. And your master class on Saturday. 14.
And I'm sure the schedule of events is somewhere.
Right. If you go to our website, wab.org, right on our landing page under our news section, there's a piece called Author Appearances, Sonia Livingston, and that's mm-hmm. got the times, the locations, directions, everything you need to know how to get to Sonia over those 4 or 5 days.
She also chooses in her memoir, and again, there's a lot of choices we make mm-hmm. as authors and which stories to tell, etc. But you choose to not, I think, overextend the goal of happy endings, and that dovetails perfectly with The Last American Virgin. You had this, mm-hmm. which is a movie I haven't seen, by the way. It's 1982, I think, right?
It's early 80s.
Okay, yeah.
I think it's a good thing you probably didn't see. It's not a great film.
Not considered.
I'm
not like, you know, Jack Garner wouldn't say, Evan Dawson, how have you not seen The Last American Virgin? But you had an affection for it because it didn't have the perfectly wrapped with a bow ending.
Mm-hmm.
And there are several stories, especially in this section of the book. Well, frankly, the whole second section mm-hmm. of the book mm-hmm. is not perfectly wrapped with a bow. And we'll get to that in a moment. But that's life, that it isn't always that way. You were a young girl. I think you said you were in fifth grade when there mm-hmm. was an older girl on the street
mm-hmm.
Who liked the bad boy on the street.
Oh, right, yes.
And she used to kind of dish to very few people, but you were one of them, about mm-hmm. this bad boy she liked.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're reading this story, and there were a couple of little pivots. I mean, first of all, mm-hmm. it's very evocative of all of our childhoods. We had these illicit moments where, you know, are we allowed to talk about this, or I'm going to show you this.
Mm-hmm.
So the girl, I forget the girl's name, was it Leah?
Leah,
okay. So Leah calls you over, you go up to her room.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the past, she's talking about this boy that mm-hmm. The bad boy that she probably shouldn't like.
Right.
And you were hoping she'd probably just talk a little bit more about him and then let you borrow some more of her clothes.
Well, I really just wanted her to apply makeup so I could learn those rules. You know, like I was interested in her because she was the prettiest girl on the street, and she seemed elegant in that way, and she had a ton of makeup and a vanity, and yes, she had the bad boyfriend, but I really wanted her to, like, show me how to use blusher. And the memory is related to her showing me a brochure and me just not getting what she was trying to talk to me about. And it was a brochure that was an anti-abortion brochure with very graphic images. So the essay ends up looking at fertility issues very, you know, as a young girl trying to figure out what that meant, abortion.
Yeah, it was the scene kind of all of a sudden comes to this halt. She's showing you this image. You said then, and I want to ask you now, you really didn't get it? You really didn't kind of see it?
No,
she wanted you to see it. She was kind of blown away by this image of graphic images of abortion. You weren't really seeing it.
I wasn't. It's funny because I grew up with a lot of like harshness or seeing lots of things that you don't think children maybe should see or not. Actually, they shouldn't see. But I did. I was clueless in a lot of ways, and I was pretty clueless. And also, I was focused really on her. I'm not being superficial. I really wanted her to apply eyeliner, you know. So this brochure, I just didn't get what she could be talking about. It blew my mind when she said abortion. In the essay, I'm wondering about that and what she might do with her beauty, how she might turn out.
And it took, I really mean this, it took two paragraphs into that essay for us to really like this person.
Mm-hmm.
Because you describe her as having just about all the things that the girls wanted. Beautiful mm-hmm. skin, beautiful hair, she was mm-hmm. gorgeous, she moved so freely, all these things. But she was also so nice. She was a good person. Mm-hmm. You know, she wasn't one of these stereotypical mean girls.
Right.
And then all of a sudden she shows you this. She's really horrified by it. And as the reader, you're thinking, she's going to get away from this bad boy. You know, she's scared by this image. She's not going to go down that road. And it didn't happen that way.
No. In fact, she may, if I look back at it and, you know, think, why was she showing me that? Perhaps she was pregnant at the time. I don't know. But she certainly was thinking about whether abortion was a good thing or a bad thing. And we were all on that street I think we were all Catholic families, mostly attending the same church, not a typical Catholic church, but still a Catholic church. And so it was clear that abortion was wrong for her anyway. I was just sort of learning about it. So I think she was thinking about this, but she wasn't verbalizing it. She was just showing me this brochure and saying, isn't this awful?
Yeah, and you did touch on, and I don't know if it was exactly here or a little later, because mm-hmm. again, a lot of it's blending together, mm-hmm. so I apologize, Sonia.
No, that's fine.
But you know, you touched on the dilemma, without getting overly political. Mm-hmm. I certainly don't want listeners to think that you become really political. I don't think hardly at any point. But mm-hmm. You do mention that push and pull, because there was that absolutist reaction to abortion that some
right.
people around you had.
Right.
And then there was that reality of seeing poverty,
mm-hmm.
seeing young girls
mm-hmm.
with babies on their laps
mm-hmm.
and knowing what cycle, you know, is likely to happen.
Right.
And I'm curious to know, looking back, how early that dissonance kind of occurred to you.
Pretty early. And actually, that may have led to this this memoir or collection of essays about women, because my first book was about child poverty, just plain and simple. And then I began to think more about that fact that so many friends who did stay poor or weren't able to at least be as successful or get out of the neighborhood had children really young. And at the time, Rochester was maybe number one in New York State for teenage pregnancy. And so I learned very young to equate pregnancy with failure. And when I travel around and people ask me, how did you get out of poverty? I often still say, you know, it was luck and not getting pregnant in high school. It wasn't virtue. It was luck, really. And I think some of the other essays take the turn when I'm older, I can't get pregnant. And then I begin to look at fertility in a different way and what it means to not be able to get pregnant.
Yeah, that was a very interesting juxtaposition. Let's mm-hmm. take a short break. We're going to come back in our second half hour. We'll move into the second part of Sonia's book. And I want to talk about language. She has this, I loved the way certain words Sonia hangs on. And I have a question for the author. I don't know if she's considered, and it's a geeky writer kind of a question, but I've been wanting to ask you this. So let's get a break. We'll get that question, and we'll talk about the second half of the book. It's Queen of the Fall, a memoir of girls and goddesses by Sonia Livingston, a Rochester native. She's in town now for Writers and Books. It's if all of Rochester reads the same book, and it is you could pick up the book right after the show and be done by dinner time. It is svelte. It is moving. Much more with Sonia next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, we sit down with Mark Cassini, the Gatestown supervisor and the Republican candidate for Congress who is once again challenging Democrat Louise Slaughter. Recently, we had Mrs. Slaughter on the program. Mr. Cassini will join us to tell us about the race, the issues that matter, And he'll tell us who he wants on the top of the ticket for Republicans, Mark Cassini, on Thursday.
Last year, 150,000 Afghans arrived in Germany. Germans want most of them returned to Afghanistan.
We have a huge number of Afghans who are not eligible to stay in Germany and should be sent back.
We'll meet some of the Afghans who have already returned home later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Sonia Livingston, author, not only in town as a guest of Writers and Books, but you go way back with Writers and Books, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I took one of my first, if not my first, writing class at Writers and Books, and it was great to have that option because I didn't know anything about writing as a, you know, a major in college or anything. So I took the community writing class, and it was wonderful.
Well, when it comes to language, you will notice when you read Queen of the Fall that there are certain words that Sonia hangs on and thinks about and kind of ponders over. And I love the thought of it because essentially the first place I noticed this was, I forget the girl's name, the girl whose name sounded like a prayer.
Yes, that was, and I changed names. So okay. I had to make, I think in the book it's Lamarata.
Lamarata, mm-hmm. Which is, of course it sounds like a prayer. It's a beautiful thing. I love the way you thought about just that name, the meaning, and then there are various words throughout the book. The word pleasure has this mellifluous rhythm to it, mm-hmm. that is almost pleasureful to say.
Yeah.
The word cirrhosis sounds like what it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The word sterile, you said, is almost like this jagged, hurtful term.
Mm-hmm.
Barren is almost a brown,
It,
and so you think about words a lot, don't you? I love that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely like language. And I think sometimes I can go too far with that. You know, some readers don't like language as much. But I, when you look at writing and especially nonfiction, there's this line, there's content versus style. And I definitely like to play with language a whole lot. And I write poetry, but have settled on the essay as my chosen form. So I think that love of language and sounds, the sounds of things, and noticing that, I think we all do that as human beings when we speak to each other. If you were to hear, it's like we have great rhythm, we say really interesting things, but I've always loved paying attention to that.
But what I'm wondering is this: the word cirrhosis definitely it kind of sounds awful.
It is, yeah, and it is awful.
And
it's an ugly word.
It's an ugly word. Mm-hmm. It's an ugly thing. Sterile, I agree. It has a jagged
scalpel sound.
A scalpel. Mm-hmm. That's what she writes in the book, and I couldn't agree more. Do those words have that sound because we know what the meaning is, and then we start to ascribe that? In other words, if the word pleasure and the word sterile were flipped, would we think the same thing? If the word sterile meant pleasure, would all of a sudden we say, oh, sterile, it rolls off the tongue. It's I don't think so, which is why I think there are certain words you land on, but I'm wondering, do we do that to the words, or do the words naturally have some of those edges?
Yeah. Yeah. A linguist would have a great answer for this, but I do notice that words that are pleasing tend to be very soft, right? Like I can't imagine sterile replacing the word suave, which sounds exactly like what it is, right? Like somebody who's suave is just suave.
Yeah.
You know, but in harder words tend to use hard consonants. So I don't know the origin of that, but it doesn't seem like a mistake. I think we know what we're about with language.
I mean, like if the word gout, which is like a dull hammer of a word.
It's a terrible word. Yeah.
If gout and chocolate were replaced, there's no
Americans
way.
Americans would be underweight. Yeah.
There's no way.
Right.
There's no way I'd be like, oh,
I need some more gout.
I love dark gout. I like milk gout, but I really love dark gout.
Right, right. And have you tried the Dutch gout?
The Dutch gout?
Right.
So I do think there are certain words that really are perfect for their purpose.
I think you're right.
But your book had me thinking, like, if we reverse them, would we feel the same way? And I think the answer is no, which is why I do think certain ones stand out to you.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that digression.
No, it's really interesting. I'm really interested in language. I love that you were thinking about those things.
And now you want to go get some dark gout.
I might think twice next time I get gout.
A little gout before bed, just a little gout, little gout and red wine. went out and read one.
Oh.
So Val LeBanc and the engineer saying, move on. You've covered
please,
that ground.
Please, please.
My guest is Sonia Livingston, the author of Queen of the Fall, a memoir of girls and goddesses. Not her only book. Your first book was?
Ghost Bread, which was about early childhood here in Rochester and Western New York, which includes Orleans County, the Indian Reservation near Batavia and a couple other places, but essentially Northeast Rochester. Yeah. I went to East High School, Corpus mm-hmm. Christi.
And what else do you have working on? What's next, forthcoming?
What's forthcoming is a book in 6 days. Not that I'm counting it down.
I know it's in my office.
Oh, okay. it's called Ladies' Night at the Dreamland. And it also focuses on women. They're essays instead of being just memoirs or focusing just on my own personal experiences, I write profiles of little-known American women, along with some who are better known. Susan B. makes another appearance, and some local people are the Fox Sisters or Adelaide Crapsey, who's a really amazing poet from Rochester.
The Fox Sisters, with the whole...
Yeah,
mysticism.
Yeah, right. So they were great to write about, because I wonder about these girls who claim to hear a ghost or heard a ghost or spirit or whatever you believe, but here they were in 1848 putting
Hoax
themselves. But in 1848, two girls, right?
Yeah.
Girls were not supposed to talk or not supposed to put themselves mm-hmm. in the limelight. So I was really interested in that. Like, what was going on that they were comfortable doing that or did it? So that's next. And then I'm working on a novel that I have a sabbatical for next year. So I'll be back getting some watching people in Western New York and writing.
All right, I lied a bit. We're going to move into the second part of the book, because the book has three distinct sections. But mm-hmm. before I get there, I thought there was a lot that was so interesting to me watching you and your experience through the Corpus Christi community.
Mm-hmm.
Because so much of what I know about Corpus Christi, I moved to Rochester almost 14 years ago.
Right.
So
right.
A lot of the really, I guess, controversial stuff
right.
was playing out.
Mm-hmm.
And now, of course... It's still a very strong and vibrant and well-known community, but
right.
you had this split,
mm-hmm.
And you were there when a lot of those seeds were kind of sowing.
Yes.
And I found that so interesting, because mm-hmm. it was in some ways, you talk about liberation theology,
mm-hmm.
and it was quite liberal in those days.
Right.
So that was interesting to peer into. You seem to have a lot of affection for those memories.
I do, yeah. It was a really progressive community even then. I was baptized there, so before its iteration as a progressive community. I suspect, though, that it was probably still progressive. I think inner-city Catholic churches tend to be places where amazing work is being done. And the neighborhood kids are welcomed, and lots of good things happen in those communities. But yeah, I loved it. I was an altar girl, and...
Which was controversial, right?
It must have been, but at the time it felt natural because,
sure.
We were all altar girls.
Yeah.
We were all altar. There were many altar girls. I said earlier, people ask me, how did you get out of poverty or how did you make it out? I never have a complete answer, but part of the answer is the acceptance and the love from that community. So even, I loved hearing the Bible stories, but even more than that, just connecting with this wonderful community was really great. And I still attend the church when I'm in town. It's now called Our Lady of the Americas on East Main Street.
Talking to Sonia Livingston, in the second part of the book, after all of the talk about what virginity meant, the brush with abortion that she didn't understand, all mm-hmm. of these becoming a woman sort of issues that everybody faces growing up, that all girls face. Then, as an adult, you were married and you wanted a child.
Mm-hmm.
And the I guess, heartbreaking thing was that you spent part of your teenage years thinking, I can't get pregnant.
Right.
You had that moment where, please God, do not let me be pregnant. I will do anything.
Right. Yeah.
And then thinking that you snap a finger, you can get pregnant, and all mm-hmm. of a sudden you want to, and you can't.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't.
Yeah. I was aware, probably not at the time, in my mid-20s when I was trying to get pregnant, or later 20s. But now, as an older woman without children, I do look at that and I think I even wrote in one of the essays, did I pray too hard not to be pregnant? Because that was very clear to me that would close doors. I didn't know where the doors were leading, but it seemed like everybody knew that a girl who got pregnant in high school, you weren't going to go on, you weren't going to be successful. And part of what I ask, I think, in some of the later essays is that true? I have a niece who I talk about who got pregnant, dropped out of Marshall High School pregnant, and it was a sad thing for me to think about her getting pregnant and how hard things would be and what a smart girl she is. She has a beautiful son, and her life will be rich in a way that mine is not. So just really just questioning like what it means to be successful, what it means to be fertile. And not to glamorize or say I was wrong about not wanting to get pregnant. I wouldn't be where I am now if I had. But to look at that question with a little more complexity, I guess.
You went through so much that is very relatable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I, you know, this is not news to you, but I think it's amazing how when you move throughout your 20s, throughout your 30s, how many friends we have who mm-hmm. have either not been able to have kids or have miscarriages are mm-hmm. a lot more common, I think, mm-hmm. than we're led to believe growing up for some reason. I think a lot of people feel like it's a shock or it's rare. It's not.
Right.
So you went through a lot with that. I just want to ask you if you could about how close you came, or at least thinking you were going to be able to eventually and the challenge, I think, of having it and losing it,
right,
et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, I had several miscarriages. I write a lot more about the fertility treatments or the infertility treatments because that was more, in some ways, more shocking or foreign to me. I tried. We had several miscarriages. And for me, what came up, because I suspect that people who have children at least have some ambivalence, maybe a little bit. But when you're trying, when you're going through fertility treatment, that ambivalence comes up a lot. So I'm also weighing like, what am I doing here? And so even when I had the sadnesses and the losses, I wasn't always 100% sure that this is what I was supposed to be doing. And so when we stopped trying, that was a question for me, like how long do I keep going? How many miscarriages is too many? And I sort of talk about this in the middle of the book. And you're right that we don't talk about this. It's not a pleasant conversation. It's not like you're going to just drop down with somebody and start talking about it. But at the same time, it's a big part of women's lives, or actually everybody's lives. And I've had many people come up to me after readings and say, thank you for writing those essays in particular, because I've never shared my struggle with fertility or miscarriage.
Absolutely. And I thought it was interesting that for all the effort that you did put forward to have a child, there were still certain things when it came to treatment or methods that you said no.
Right, right.
Which was interesting, because it seemed like you were really pushing to do it, and you were obviously going through a lot to begin with.
Right.
It's not like you hadn't even started. You'd gone through a lot, but there are certain things you did not want to do. Was that a signal to you of that ambivalence, I guess?
I think so. I think some people know for sure that that's what they want, right? And they will do anything, and they do it, right? It's like a lot of things. It's like writing, in a way. Lots of people want to write, but to keep going, you have to do it. And I was aware that I wasn't willing to do certain things. And I think also I was thinking, what's wrong with me? Because in my family, we might not all finish high school, but everybody knows how to have a baby, you know? So I was kind of looking at my body in that way, like, why is it not working? And I think the more help or treatment I received, it just seemed like the bigger the failure was. It was something like that. But yes, ambivalence, like I mentioned a minute ago, was definitely there.
We opened the hour with that story on you on the phone with your mother.
Mm-hmm.
That was jarring.
Yes.
It must have been jarring for you. It was jarring for me to read about it.
It was jarring, but, you know...
Because, again, for the listeners who are just coming in late.
Yeah.
You had news to share to your mom. You call her and kind of set that scene a little bit.
Right. So I call and say, I'm pregnant. I think after a few miscarriages, I'm saying, hey, it's worked out. And she says, oh, great, me too. Right? So me too. But it's jarring.
She was 58.
Yeah, 58. But the thing about it is my mother is a really interesting woman. She's colorful. I guess it shouldn't have jarred me, because she sort of does say surprising things. It turns out that she had endometrial cancer, and though she was experiencing very early signs of it, but wasn't willing to face that. And I think that was pretty common in my growing up, that in a good way and a bad way, that she wasn't willing to face certain things. So if a bill came in that she couldn't pay, she'd just throw it away. It was just too much. And I think the same thing with her body. Like, she didn't know what cancer might be, but she knew that when her abdomen was swollen, that was a pregnancy, because she'd had so many. So it is shocking. You know, it's the one essay I almost didn't include in the book,
Why?
I think I was afraid people would judge her too harshly. And even though that is a moment that is, I could understand people judging, I think she was in her own struggle with something that was really big.
I want to tell you why I didn't end up judging her harshly, mm-hmm. even though as you took us through that chapter, mm-hmm. I was judging her. Mm-hmm. But I'll just give you my perspective as a reader here.
Okay.
I actually felt that it was one of the most isolated and lonely parts of the book because, first of all, you've got news to share after everything mm-hmm. you've gone through.
Right.
And you're calling your own mother, and she doesn't say, oh, great, tell me about that. How are you feeling? She turns it around on herself. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, your news is completely shelved. Mm-hmm. She's telling you something that is obviously untrue, and you know it's untrue based on the conversation you're having with her.
Right.
You know she cannot be pregnant.
Right, right.
She's telling you without any question in her mind, she is pregnant.
Right.
And you are beginning to realize not only is she not pregnant, she's probably got something wrong here.
Right, right.
So you had this heartbreaking sort of moment with that. Your own joy gets shelved. Mm-hmm. And your husband's on the couch watching the game, not picking up on any of the signals something is going on here.
Right.
And just that distance, you were 10 feet away from him, felt like a long distance to me as a reader. And I really felt for you there because mm-hmm. of everything that you had gone through mm-hmm. for this to be the moment.
Right.
I did feel for you. And I was angry. At your husband, I was angry at your mother, but then I felt sympathy because I think mm-hmm. I felt like, my goodness, I think her mother is in denial mm-hmm. about something, mm-hmm. And yes, quirky for sure.
Yes.
58 and is absolutely convinced she's pregnant.
Yes.
But I felt very sad, mm-hmm. and my feelings on her changed just to sadness because you didn't have to tell us by the end of that chapter what we already knew.
Right. Okay. Well, that's a good perspective. And, you know, the one thing also is when you write something, you shine a light on that thing, for better or worse. And so I know my mother in a larger context, and I know that her first husband, I'm no longer married to him, but in a larger context. But the reader just gets that scene. And so as a writer, when you include those, I try to weigh, like, what is it that I'm portraying here in wanting it to be fair and to stand for something larger than that particular moment? And I think it does. The truth is, I love my mother. She's a great person, but I by then did not expect that she would probably be able to celebrate with me about good news.
Yeah. The book is Queen of the Fall, a memoir of girls and goddesses by Sonia Livingston, a Rochester native who is in town for a series of events. Chris Fanning from Writers and Books is here. You can find the schedule of events. You've got a lot going on. And the neat thing about what Writers and Books does here is they create this opportunity for the community to read a book, mm-hmm. and then you've got opportunities to talk about it, to meet the author. There are writers' workshops, so you kind of hit it from a wide range of angles. Tell us a little bit about what's coming up.
Yeah, this is our largest community reading program we do every year. Our kickoff is actually back in February when we were here for a First Friday discussion. Discussions, panels, films, book groups, lunch meetings, a bus tour. Pretty much everything that we can get out there surrounding the themes of the book leading up to the author come, because we want to reach as many people as we can. These mm-hmm. are all great free readings at huge local venues, so we want to get as many people together for a big book club as mm-hmm. we can.
Mm-hmm. The book, you did the bus stuff?
We did mm-hmm. the bus stuff.
Where did
that
you
was
go?
Sunday. That was a blast.
That was a blast. Well, we went to places from both Ghost Bread and Queen of the Fall. So let me know if I forgot the place, Chris.
Okay.
But number 33 school, we went to Lamont Place, which is the street we ended up on in the city. Mm-hmm. And where's Savoya Pastry Shop was the
I
big
I love that Savoya got a shout out in the book. I've been getting these frosted fig cookies there for years.
Oh, my God. They're the best. And Savoya gets a shout out in every book I've written so far, which is tells you about my love for gout. Sorry, Chris. We went to Corpus Christi Church and the Susan B. Anthony House.
Susie B. Wonderful. Was great. That we stopped there and had tea and had a tour. Mm-hmm. Everybody on the bus got to get off and walk around the museum. That was awesome. That was a highlight for me.
Yeah,
Is it weird? Is it interesting? Is it exactly what you wanted? Do people want to ride the bus with you after reading your life story? And you know, what's that like?
It is weird. It is. I was a little afraid at first. I thought, oh, I trust Writers in Books. It's been a great program. Like, we forgot to say that there was a mythological themed cocktail hour at Knox. But anyway, so great programming. But when I got on the bus, everything changed because it wasn't just about my life. It was about people from Rochester getting to know Rochester through my work or having their own experiences. So it was really a wonderful experience.
All right. Well, I'll just touch a little bit on the third and final section of the book because we got about 7 minutes left with Sonia here. Mm-hmm. And the book is, again, organized in three sections, but the first one, more like a collection of essays, right? Mm-hmm. Right. Second one, more of a singular story that mm-hmm. gets told. Mm-hmm. And let our listeners know how you decided to do the third section.
Well, I mean, they're all actually individual essays that right. are grouped together because they're based on memory, so they're memoir together. And the third section, I want to tell them, but I'm really interested in how you see the third section because I think you read this very carefully.
Well, for me, mm-hmm. I guess I will say there are certain themes that carried all the way through mm-hmm. that show up in different places. And all the way, you know, to the very end here, when you're, I think, tipping a cap to someone who is very important in your life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I don't think I'm the best person to plow that field.
Okay. Well, I'll talk about it. I'm not sure how the organization, how you see it, but for me, it is several more personal essays, and they talk about leaving that first marriage and taking my first writing class, other than Writers in Books, at SUNY Brockport with a local Judith Kitchen, an amazing essayist.
You dedicated the book to?
I did, yeah, because she passed away last year, but she just well-regarded in the literary community and was a local treasure for years. And I just happened to take this class. I wasn't sure I wanted to. It was called The Creative Essay, which sounded like unfun. It sounded like Susan B. Anthony. It sounded not fun, right? So I thought, why am I going to take this? But it amazed me how an essay could work, how they could look at things like language. You could use this form in a way that you might use a poem. And so I talk about that. I talk about working with children as a counselor out in Hilton. I was a counselor in city schools for a while, but mostly out in Hilton in the high school and then eventually the elementary school. And there's an essay that talks about those girls, particularly girls. I worked with boys and girls. And then I talk about the move to Memphis. And I think that what happens in that last section is I look at different ways that we are fertile and different ways that we are creative, and end the book with a scene in a laundromat in Memphis, Tennessee, and interacting with a woman, an older woman doing her laundry about having children. And so that's where I end the book, is sort of where I am now in Memphis.
Yeah. So when it comes to fertility mm-hmm. and everything that you kind of bared open for us to mm-hmm. see that you went through,
mm-hmm.
I did, I don't know if I got a sense of, boy, resolution, I don't know if that's the right word, mm-hmm. but where you are now and mm-hmm. the way you view creativity and mm-hmm. fertility.
Mm-hmm.
And how are you with all of that now?
I'm okay. Thank you for asking.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny to talk about because definitely not having children when I wanted to was hard. That was a loss. But I also can't say that my life isn't extremely rich right now. I mean, I don't know how it would have gone. In other words, if I'd had children, that would have been wonderful, but there would have been other losses. So I think life is about making these choices or not making these choices, maybe just dealing with what we have in front of us. And a lot of the essays or pieces talk about the way that sorrow and beauty are naturally entwined, that, you know, you can't have one without the other. So I'm happy. I feel like my life has been wonderful, and I love teaching. My students are important to me. I love writing and just getting to be here. You know, it's great, rich experiences.
And you even weighed in on Allie McBeal.
I did talk about Allie McBeal,
which I thought was cool.
Yeah, yeah. And Al Green, because, you know, Al Green is right down in Memphis, and I love going to his church. But yes, so I look at some pop culture icons, the lady from the Land O'Lakes Butter Box and the Virgin Mary and Susan B. and Allie McBeal. So I was looking at personal examples of women and girlhood, but also cultural examples.
And any problems you had with the character arc of Allie McBeal?
Yeah, I did. I didn't like the way the show... Right, and that show ends with a fertility issue. A daughter shows up after a botched donation. It's so funny that we're talking about Ally McBeal. This is officially my favorite radio show.
Well, you wrote about it.
I know, but you could have just skipped it. I even forgot about it. But yeah, so Ally McBeal, just as a symbol of being a successful woman. And, you know, she's a lawyer, but judged for her looks. And in the end, has a daughter as her happy ending.
Which, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe not the best way to wrap it up.
Right. I mean, she had Al Green. She didn't need that. Yeah.
Yeah. I also appreciate, I think, and we touched on it earlier this hour, your background coming from poverty, understanding that there are events that happen that, you know, as you said, when you were a teenager, you know that girls who got pregnant, it's not going to be a good outcome,
right.
Which is interesting to have that self-awareness,
mm-hmm.
and yet so many girls still got pregnant.
Right.
And then as an adult, seeing your niece and, mm-hmm. and thinking about, you know, where you come from, what your means are, and what it means for you,
mm-hmm.
you know, at certain ages, if you're 16 years old and pregnant,
mm-hmm.
you know, someone in a wealthy suburb is going to be probably in a different scenario than
right.
someone in poverty.
Mm-hmm.
I've appreciated reading about your perspective on those things.
Well, thank you. Thanks.
Yeah. And then there were also some things as a counselor you saw, or at least were connected to some things that ended tragically. Not you, but for kids that you have met.
Right.
Off air, I have some separate questions about that.
Okay.
But we'll let readers, because Megan Mack, the producer of this program, also read the book, and she had some questions as well, and we were talking
sure.
about some of the things that you saw there. But anyway, the bottom line is, the book is Queen of the Fall. It's beautiful. And I just want to close with this. How have you been doing in terms of receiving just audience reader feedback here? You know, because obviously people are riding the bus with you.
Yeah.
Coming to these events.
Well,
but is this hitting the way you want it to?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I'm getting lots of, you know, I have experiences that are amazing. At Geneseo, somebody in the bathroom said, I found one of your pieces in Lake Effect magazine, which is in here. It's called Clotilda's Cake. It's a sort of a profile of my mother-in-law. And she said, it's the best thing I've ever read. I don't know if that's true or not, but it was great to hear. And I think people do respond because of the local connection, but also the themes. I think other people might struggle with the fact that it's a collection of essays versus a memoir. But in general, people have been very positive.
I not for a moment found any issue with the structure. Loved it.
Okay.
Queen of the Fall, the book's now available, and you can get it at Writers and Books, I assume, Chris.
We've got copies and copies and copies. That, mm-hmm. Ghost Bread, and we just ordered the next book, too. So
great.
We'll have that for
great.
Sale at all the readings.
Congratulations on all the success with
Thank
this.
Thank you.
Are you online? Do you have a website, Sonia
I
Livingston?
Do, SoniaLivingston.com.
Sonia with a J.
Right.
SoniaLivingston.com. Best of luck in this. Have fun in Rochester. It's great to have you back in your hometown.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And much deserved on the success. Chris, great pick. A lot of fun.
I'll tell the staff.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. Thanks to Val LaBanca for being the conscience of this program and keeping me straight and narrow this hour. Thanks to Mariel Brinkerhoff and Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson. We will talk to you Thursday.